Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Montana is known for its wealth of natural resources. Gold, silver, copper. But some of our greatest resources are writers.
Shan Ray grew up in both Livingston, Montana, and on the Crow and Cheyenne Reservation. His recently published novel is American Copper, set at the end of the 19th century.
The book's title actually refers to a butterfly and not a copper baron from Butte.
Yes, American Copper is an exploration of a love triangle between the daughter of a mining tycoon, a shy rodeo cowboy, and a university-educated son of a Native American tribal chief.
Whereas Russell Rowland's contemporary travelogue is a personal look at all 56 counties in Montana. Rowland brings us in quickly with tales of all of these characters of different natures, the wildness of the Old West, the isolating harshness of place, and the dedicated, determined nature of the strong, idealistic characters of Montana.
Both of these prolific Montana writers give us a fresh perspective on the character of place. Welcome, Russell.
Yes, thanks for having me, and congratulations on getting this show started. I think Billings needs something like this.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Absolutely.
So my first question is, you and Lynn Stegner co-edited an anthology of writers, West of 98, Living and Writing the New American West. And I'm wondering, did that process make you want to explore a little bit more about your own state in your book, 56 Counties?
Yes, absolutely. You know, when I moved back to Montana, I had been gone for 25 years and had lived pretty much all over the United States. And so my fascination with the West was really rekindled when I came back. And there was a lot of things about it that I wanted to explore. And of course, that anthology was a great starting point. We asked writers from every state west of the Mississippi to write about their experience of growing up here, how it formed them as people and as artists. And yeah, it definitely triggered my curiosity about Montana itself, which I've always been fascinated with anyway. So yeah, for sure.
Well, in 56 counties, you've done an incredible amount of historical research and a lot of miles covered. You describe the travel research sort of as spontaneous and inquisitive, too. So what did you discover in that spontaneity?
That was a big part of how I wanted to approach this project. I didn't want it to be very planned out or mapped out. I had a few interviews planned in advance, but most of it was spontaneous because I really wanted to get people's views without having them think too much about it. Plus I wasn't really sure how long I would be in any one place, so I couldn't plan a lot of my interviews in advance anyway. I wanted it to be as instinctive as possible.
Well, and for people that haven't seen the book, even though it's called 56 Counties, it's not alphabetical or geographical, so there isn't every chapter on each one of those counties. How you put it together is really interesting.
Yeah, it's based on chapter themes, right?
Yeah, the chapters, yeah, I started out actually, the first draft was organized by county, and it was too boring. I mean, it basically ended up being like a travel guide, and that wasn't what I wanted at all. I wanted to explore the spirit of Montana and what it is that's going on all over the state and all the different industries, so I ended up organizing it that way by industry. So each chapter focuses on a specific money-making industry that supports the state, and we have so many resources here that there's a ton of them, so that made it pretty interesting.
And so different, too.
Yes,
the right. Size of the state and the whole geography makes it so different from one side of the state to the other.
Exactly, yeah.
What did you sort of discover in terms of those particular regions? Was there a character of the East, of the Northwest, of the Southwest?
Yeah, I think for sure the Eastern Montana is much more guarded. The people in eastern Montana have a history of really, really struggling. And there's just a sort of hesitancy there that you don't see so much in the western part of the state. They are just as friendly and just as easy to get to know, but they are definitely slower to let you in. I think there's also, you know, there's a distrust of the government that we all know about in Montana, this sort of libertarian bent that runs all over the state. And I think it's particularly evident in the eastern part of the state where there's one of the people I interviewed described it, you know, people are looking for a common enemy. And because they've struggled so long and still never really made a mark, they all have to have this common enemy, and the government makes a pretty convenient target for all of these people.
So your first two books were about, or based on, your family in southeast Montana. Did that help you sort of understand a little bit more about the flavor of eastern Montana?
Yeah, definitely. You know, I actually worked on the ranch when I was a teenager. It was in Carter County. And, of course, that's another thing about this trip, too, is it sort of gave me an in, you know, telling people that my grandparents were homesteaders was a great way to get people to trust me a little bit more about what I was up to. But my family history does give me a lot of insight into how the history of the state has played out and some of the problems that we face.
Yeah, you become such a character almost in this novel. And I was curious, you know, talking about your grandparents' ranch on the way to Broadus and watching that community dwindle in size, or growing up in Billings in the 70s and returning in 07. So what is your connection to place?
Well, yeah, I have kind of an interesting connection to Montana because I was gone for so long, but I also have this long history here. So I was fortunate enough, because I worked on the ranch, to understand the connection between us and the land and us and the animals. In fact, the part I'm going to read a little bit here talks about that. But I also have, I think, you know, being able to live in so many different other places and seeing how that kind of connection to place is not really evident in a lot of parts of our country. And so it's something I really think is unique about the West, but particularly Montana. I don't know what it is about Montana that makes it a place that people really are proud to identify with. I talk about in the introduction about how Montana is the number one state for being happy. I've also read there was a poll that said the people that are the most proud of their state, we were in the top three for that one. So there's a real connection to this place.
Also a great deal of depression too, and hardship, and built throughout this homesteading nature, this fierceness of developing, you know, economy in such a harsh landscape. And you really do a good job of painting those pictures.
Thank you.
Yeah, I find your voice throughout the book is really comforting. There's this clean journalistic style, but you have rich storyteller narration. The rhythm to your writing is really informal but conversational.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Would there be a favorite passage maybe you'd like to share with
sure,
us?
Sure, yeah. This part where I'm going to read is talks a little bit about my experience with living on the ranch, or actually visiting the ranch when I was a kid. One day when I was about 8, my grandparents took me to spend the day at the neighbor's, who had a boy the same age. Kelly Cornerman was a typical ranch kid. He was quiet but friendly, with a dry wit and a great sense of adventure. When I went to visit Kelly, I knew it was going to be a good day. On this particular day, Kelly asked me whether I'd ever ridden a calf. Of course, I said. But this was a bold-faced lie. I was a Montana kid, and my dad had been on the rodeo team at Montana State University, So I just knew, in the way that kids know things without any evidence whatsoever, that I would be able to ride that calf like a real cowboy. Kelly took me to the barn, and he fixed me up with chaps, gloves, and even spurs. He fastened a rigging around the calf's torso and showed me how to tuck my hand tight around that rope. We guided the calf into the chute, where I lowered myself from the rails onto his back. Kelly whipped the gate open just like they do at the days of 85, and for about 5 seconds I rode that calf like a champion. But suddenly the calf stopped dead in its tracks and I went flying. The way I remember it, I looked sort of like Superman, but I think there's a good chance I looked a lot more like someone falling off a calf. I landed flat on my stomach, and my legs kicked up so that my spurs popped me right in the back. For the next 10 minutes, I was pretty sure I was going to die. Kelly must have thought the same thing because he rolled me onto my back and he was crying like a baby. And then he did something I didn't understand at all. He crawled down to my feet and he started to pull my boots off. What Kelly and I didn't know was that his father, Donnie, was watching this whole scene play out from the barn, laughing his ass off. And for years afterward, both of our families had a good laugh over the fact that Kelly Cornerman wasn't about to let his friend die with his boots on.
That's wonderful. And I bet they were probably his size.
Yeah, probably. Probably.
So, Russell, having traveled across our state, do you have any advice for maintaining or amending sort of the character of our state?
Well, the thing that really struck me about what's happening right now in Montana is that the places that are doing well are places that are embracing the idea that we need to approach our economy from a different angle. There's a lot of places that are very hesitant to take tourism seriously, but tourism has slowly inched its way up into second place on our economic structure behind agriculture. And, you know, and of course, in eastern Montana, it's not really tourist friendly. I mean, there's not a lot of attractions there, but the more that some of these places have sort of amped up that kind of the what we have to offer here. And, you know, people come from all over the world to this place just to, you know, they save up for years to come to Montana for a couple weeks. So it has a lot of potential. Tech companies coming into Bozeman and up by Kalispell are doing really well. So there's a lot of opportunities we have to utilize what we have here, especially the quality of life that people love about this place. And I think we need to focus more on that. The agriculture is just not going to last much longer the way it looks right now. I mean, it's always going to be there, of course, but as far as being a primary source of income, it's just on the decline, and it's hard to come to terms with that, I know.
Well, thank you so much for being with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Yes.
Appreciate it.
And we've been talking with Russell Rowland and his new book, 56 Counties, an exploration of Montana from every corner.
Thanks.
Poet and prose writer Shan Ray's powerful, graceful writing is set in the American West, considers the nature of humanity with regards to violence and forgiveness. His collection of short stories, American Masculine, won the American Book Award, the Bakeless Prize, and two High Plains Book Awards for Best Short Story Collection and Best First Book. His book of poems, Balefire, also won the High Plains Book Award, but for poetry. And just this last year, his debut novel, American Copper, won the Western Writers of America Spur Award and was a finalist for the Washington State Book Award and the High Plains Book Award. Shan, welcome to Billings. Clearly, you are well aware of the High Plains, three awards in three different genres. Congratulations.
Thank you so much. I love the High Plains. I think it's one of the great venues and great places to gather artists around America. And I think it's because it's so well curated, so many people in Billings that love writing, they love the arts. And so I look forward to any chance I can get to be here.
You are now teaching at Gonzaga University, but you were born in Montana. Tell a little bit about your background.
Yeah. So I was born here in Billings at St. Vincent's, St. V's. I just passed it on the way here to this time with you. So good to reminisce again and come back to Billings. And my family was here for a few years. Then we moved to Alaska for 6 years, Sitka, Alaska. Then back to Billings when my dad was a principal and a coach at Plenicou. And we formed some great friendships with Crow people there and that remained throughout our lives. And then from there, we went to the Cheyenne Reservation where he was a principal and a coach. Also profound brotherhoods for me with Leif Haugen and Russell Tall White Man, Blake Walks Nice, Cleveland Bement, Terry Curley now. And these guys have been an important part of my life. Then from there on to Livingston, where I finished high school and We won a couple of state championships in basketball with my dad coaching the teams I was on with my brother. And then to Montana State, finally, for also basketball and studying communications. And then from there to Pepperdine and out to some professional basketball in Germany. And then since then, just a lot of journeys back to Montana to see my parents and spend a lot of time in the wilderness like we did growing up too, especially the Beartooth Range and the Yellowstone over near Bozeman, also the confluence that forms the Missouri, the Gallatin, the Madison, the Jefferson. A lot of time just spent in the landscapes and being out there.
Shan Ray is what you go by in terms of your poetry and fiction, but as a basketball player, Shan Furch. And you also use Shan Ray Furch for your more academic writing, is that correct?
Exactly. In our family, it was a family of men with my mom, who ended up being pretty much the spiritual core of the family and somebody who I think in general loved the arts, but we had all this massive masculine energy running through the family that entailed sports and a life of high-level sports. My brother, Crowell, ended up playing for the national volleyball team after having a great college career in basketball. So in any case, when I started coming around to writing poetry and fiction, I wanted a way to honor my mom, and her and I have the same middle name. So she's got Ray for her middle name, and I have Ray for mine, so I went with Shan Ray.
That's wonderful. Your novel is a debut novel, and even though it's not a very long book or a big book, it is epic in scope. And it talks about the Montana frontier starting in Butte, Montana, covering the place. Tell us just a little bit of the synopsis of the story, yeah. American Copper.
So it runs from basically the Sand Creek Massacre of the Cheyennes in 1864, when they were massacred by Colonel John Chivington and the troops he had drawn together, on up to about 1935, the rise of Big Copper and maybe the more full expression of Manifest Destiny. And the novel follows three characters: Evelyn, who is the daughter of a copper baron; Zion, who's a big steer wrestler from the High Line, tough bar fighter type, also with a core of tenderness that is sometimes hard to reach and sometimes easy to find, especially in brotherhood and when he's thinking of his mother and the ways that he learned life from his mother. And then we've got William Black Kettle, who's the third part of that triangle. And William Black Kettle is a great-grandson of one of the notorious peace chiefs of the Cheyenne, Black Kettle. And those three spend their time divergently in the beginning and then coming together into a type of fusion that has its own pitfalls and transcendences and looks at the nature of ultimate violence, the nature of forgiveness, and the nature of who we are as human beings across cultures and between genders.
Mm-hmm. But interestingly, the novel really begins with Joseph Lowry, who
yes.
ends up being a copper king, but he was a Czech immigrant, a
exactly.
poor person coming to America who made his fortune and is a very strong force in the lives of his daughter and son. Talk a little bit about creating that character of Joseph Lowry.
Yeah, I think I wanted to create somebody that we all knew as Montanans, somebody that has ambition, somebody that's a survivor, that's tougher than most, which I think of as most Montana people are, you know, it's sort of like a psyche of Montana to be tough, you know. And sometimes that toughness gets bent into, you know, desolation, destruction, violence. But in any case, Joseph is really a lot like the great well-known Copper Kings of Butte, Montana, in that two of those Copper Kings that ended up making millions, if not billions, they came from nothing. And so I just wanted somebody that was like that, that built up through their own sort of mental powers and often schemes an empire. And he could be symbolic of how sometimes the masculine itself just builds empire, even if it's in its own family, mm-hmm. at the extreme, you know.
And certainly he does that in
yeah.
terms of his family. His children, Evelyn and Thomas, are almost treated like property. They're
right.
very much dominated. They're directed. And the children are close to each other, but they both rebel in a certain way against their father.
That's right. And the father, I think it might have gone differently. I think his openness and his readiness to understand or come into a greater conception of love was often held by his love for his wife in the early going. and yet she dies in childbirth, giving birth to Evelyn. So he goes it alone after that. I don't, you know, I think he might have been a different, maybe better man, if that was possible. He always had a lot of power that he gave to his kids, as far as, you know, unfortunately by controlling them and dominating them, but also just by having it in his blood. I mean, both children also, you know, are on the rise to some, in some ways appropriate power, in some ways inappropriate power. Mm-hmm. And that kind of comes from his bloodline, I guess.
And yeah. Evelyn is very much like Emily
yeah.
Dickinson
and Emily,
also,
yeah.
because mm-hmm. she's a recluse, but she very quietly is publishing poetry.
That's right. You know, I think of her as, I love Emily's writing, and I love Emily's vision of America that was sort of subsurface until we were able to get ourselves to see it come to the surface with Emily Dickinson. Mm-hmm. And I think it was writing that was dominated. I think her early editors were highly patriarchal and actually shut down some writing. And she didn't go with, okay, I'm going to please you. She just went and wrote her poems and mm-hmm. decided, okay, I don't need to be publishing in these magazines that aren't going to receive these poems, you know. And I love that about Emily. And so I wanted that feel for the main character, Evelyn, in this book, too.
Two men come into her life that could not be more different. I love the character of Zion, who I think of as the bar-fighting, street brawler, steer wrestler, man who's gentle with horses.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's just a beautiful soul, yeah. but a tortured soul. And then also William Black Kettle, who was a descendant, as you said, of Cheyenne peace chiefs, but he was also educated by Catholics.
Right. And, you know, that a lot of that was to capture men that I had known and, you know, a little bit of the spectrum that, you know, there's such a wide spectrum of men with regard to how we handle ourselves in life, in sexuality, in religion, in physicality, in emotionality, in spirit. And so I wanted a couple men that were that could be brothers, but were very different too. And in a way, they had a brotherhood in the novel. They had a type of brotherhood. And so I kind of wanted to give us some expression so that we could see through their eyes some different experiences. And one, you know, the Zion, I love him too. And, you know, he has a hard time talking whenever it comes to ultimate tenderness or ultimate gracefulness. So if he's talking to a woman, it's very hard for him, you know. if he's talking about if he has to do something in the middle of a fight, he's not going to have very many words. He's going to just use the physicality. And then William is pretty much the opposite. He is beautiful with language, you know, and his emotion and his spirit comes out in a flow of really, in a way, poetry in his expressions towards Evelyn and towards anybody, towards his friends and towards his family. And I love those men as well.
Mm-hmm. So Shan Ray Furch is teaching forgiveness studies at Gonzaga University. And Shan Ray is writing a novel that's very much about forgiveness and atonement.
Right. So, yeah,
tell the theme of that. Yeah. Throughout your book.
I think we all recognize that America currently has a major crucible around what to do with our shadow. As a, you know, dominant culture, America has a major crucible, which is, and other countries we notice around the world also have that difficulty. However, some have walked through the door to try to get to what's the nature of forgiveness, asking what's the nature of atonement, what's the nature of reparations. We've had our attempts to. They are not as fully expressed as we see in some other countries around the world as of yet. Mm-hmm. The expressions of that forgiveness coming from non-dominant culture are fully expressed. So, for example, the Cheyenne ceremony in which there's a long run made from the, surrounding the Sand Creek Massacre now, and people of all cultures are welcomed into that as a ceremony of a type of coming to grips with it, coming to terms with it. Is profound. And the Nez Perce ceremony at the Big Hole Massacre, where they welcome in the descendants of those who did the massacring to be with the descendants of those who were massacred in a reconciliation ceremony where they walk through the darkness holding lanterns together into the dawn and then sit together in a reconciliation circle. Those are profound expressions that right. that's hard for our dominant culture to accept, I think, because of things that we might borrow from critical race theory and from feminist theory.
You mentioned that you were just recently back in your hometown of Livingston working with the high school on this really interesting project from Humanities Montana. Tell us a little bit about that project.
Great project. I think one of the great national projects from the humanities. This one is called the Montana Authors Project, and basically they've chosen some novels, in some cases poetry, Richard Hugo's poetry. What has happened is they've chosen sort of novels that are in some way representative of the state of Montana, not just the actual word, the physical state, but I think also the emotional and spiritual state of Montana that are housed in these novels, you know, in these poems. And so if you go to the site, Montana Authors Project, the state of Montana appears. And over on the right-hand side, you click on authors, and it pulls down maybe 10 or 11 authors of Montana that are all deep heroes and heroines of mine. And so what happens is Humanities Montana will pick, in this case, they picked Park High School, where I went to high school, and Natalie Story, who is a wonderful English teacher there, and the librarian, Kate, they both got together with Natalie's class. You know, so they looked at the novel to look at different places in the novel that focus on specific locations in Montana. And when you go to the site, American Copper's not up yet, but it'll eventually be up on the site as well. But let's take Fool's Crow, for example, by James Welch, the wonderful and stunning Blackfeet Grove On writer who won the LA Book Award, which I think should have won the Pulitzer Prize with Fool's Crow. When you click on his name on that site, you'll see a background about him and about the book Fool's Crow. And then you click on sites, and it'll pull up actual pins that just look like bulletin board pins, you know. And you click on one of those, it'll pull up 7 or 8 of those. And it'll open into a place that he wrote about,
right?
You know, and it'll have a paragraph from Fool's Crow. So it's a gorgeous way of sort of capturing all this.
And it's so fun to play with.
Yeah.
I mean, just to go to the site and think, like, where in this novel are these locations? Your book, I think, is interesting. When you mention Jim Welch, it's been compared to some of Jim Welch's work. And I sort of see that because both of you were poets. How does poetry, being a poet, influence your work as a novelist?
I think it is a very important, very vital influence. And when I look at, you know, people that are my most beloved writers are poets and novelists. They combine. And it's sometimes hard to do because sometimes a poet will write too poetically, which sometimes is inaccessible when they're writing a novel. So I think for me, as a novelist, I have to think differently than as a poet, though I want the novel to be poetic. And the difference in the thinking in general has something to do with accessibility and plot line and gathering, a type of gathering power that is going to hopefully transform the emotional life of the reader. And so that, you know, and I think James Welch did that. I think Jim Harrison with Legends of the Fall, Michael Ondaatje with English Patient. And as you look back in their work, so you look at Jim Welch, his poems, it's not that easy to comprehend or to access. But his novels are increasingly more fulfilling, I guess you would say, as a novelistic venture. Right. You know?
I think it's interesting that so many people have read Jim Harrison's novels and short stories, and not that many people know his poetry.
Right.
And I think he is a master of poetry.
And poets would say he's one of America's top poets. His legacy goes down as one of the great American poets.
I would like to encourage our listeners to find some other beautiful writing. Shan Ray has his novel, American Copper, that came out last year. My particular favorite, of course, is your short story collection, American Masculine, which I love. The opening scenes at the Billings YMCA with some Cheyenne basketball players. And then your poetry book, Balefire. Well, thank you, Shan, and carry on.
Thank you.
Continue your good writing.
Corby, it's been just such a good gift in my life to get to know you, and thank you for everything you do for Montana and the arts.
Thank you. For more information on Montana literature and the character of place, go to the Montana Authors Project at humanitiesmontana.org/map. Here you'll be able to explore Montana writers and the settings for their work.
And next week on Resounds, we visit two women making music happen in Montana, Ann Harrigan, the music director of Billings Symphony Orchestra and Chorale, and Bozeman-based jazz vocalist Jenny Fleming.
You've been listening to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains, produced by Anna Page, Corby Skinner, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Hear this program anytime online at ypradio.org.